Well, a very warm welcome to all our listeners. This is Nikhil Arora, and welcome to the first episode of season 3 of Long Shots. I have with me usual suspect, Mr. Sharad Chupran, on the phone. Hey, Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's been very good, and I don't think we ever expected that we'd start the season remotely. Let's see if when we reverse back to doing a face-to-face discussion, but this is good for now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we did a in-between seasons last episode, and yeah. I think we then had our first guest, his diary totally aligned with ours, and we were like, yeah, let's do a work-from-home edition.
So who's the guest?
Long Shots, and oh, Sharad, as if you don't know, come on, man. So Sharad is being quite orchestrated here, like, you know, we are so scripted, no? And we have with us Anuj Dayal. Hey Anuj, how's it going, man?
Hey, good to be back, guys. How are you?
Yeah, so Anuj was our first guest during season 2. And during that season, I think that episode went very well, but I think we were still testing our new gear. So his bass volume was slightly lower than we would have liked. So Anuj, we just thought, you know, we'll kind of just return the favor by now bringing you on remotely.
Right. And I promise to be louder this time.
Yeah. So, it's welcome. It's great to have you here. So I guess today is going to be another freewheeling session. So Sharad, what's on the agenda? We're going to discuss a bit of everything, but obviously the background is going to be about Mr. COVID-19 as usual. So we're going to touch a bit about, I think, the credit markets, and then we'll probably jump into, the wider macroeconomic situation in our country, right?
Yeah, and we covered all this, a fair bit of it last, when we did the work from home episode, but obviously we didn't do a deep dive into the credit side of things. We just assessed what the RBI was trying to do. So maybe we tilt our discussion towards credit, and like you said, keep it free-leaning. And obviously with Anuj involved, I know there'll be some bearish commentary around everything, from startups to equity markets. So I'm looking forward to hear that.
Yeah, so we're going to discuss Reliance and, you know, the usual stuff, of course.
I might be a bit more bullish this time, guys.
Whoa, nice. That's good. That's good to hear, man. That's good to hear. It's always good to hear positivity in this time and age. So yeah, let's straight away jump into it, right? I mean, Anuj, I think the Indian banking sector was already in probably its best shape when the coronavirus thing came in. I recall, the news flow was full of Yes Bank, what's kind of going on there. And, I think RBI had come up with a financial stability report where they were saying that there are almost like 9.3% NPAs in the banking sector. That part of the equation is not going to change for some time, right?
No, I mean, if anything, things should only get worse on that front. I mean, Nikhil, you might remember we guys were discussing this sort of offline a few days ago, that, the moratorium itself can have fairly, interesting ramifications on the sort of Indian financial system. So that should be interesting to see how it plays out. But, I think your point is completely right. Things were pretty bad even before coronavirus hit. And I think for the financial sector as a whole, they're probably only going to get worse.
That doesn't sound very bullish, bro.
Well, okay, I probably wasn't. A few sectors I'm still not bullish on.
Right. No, absolutely. No, point taken. But I mean, like, it's interesting, right? Because I think with Yes Bank, what I kind of started noticing was that most mainstream scheduled commercial banks, they were kind of, I would say deleveraging their corporate loan book, and they were moving towards retail side. I mean, even in their disclosures, it was becoming more and more evident how they were, all gradually, obviously, like guys like HDFC and all that were already doing that. But even if you look at Axis, ICICI, they all were kind of, pushing more on the retail end of the spectrum. And I guess with the coronavirus, the first victim, as Sharad, I think you also pointed out in the last podcast, would be demand. So I guess retail lending would be particularly hit. So there's no wonder that there's not a lot to be very happy about on that front.
Yeah, I mean, Yes Bank sort of made their name by sort of claiming to identify this spot, which is corporate lending, which was, you know, under-penetrated, and sort of built their book along those lines. And now, with gradually moving towards from the retail side, just want to do it, and then there is a massive retail slowdown, and you know, lending is sort of the RBI's effort sort of was to de-stress the system, but I don't know, like it's a much more calculated move, right? And this is a setback for everyone, right?
Yeah, I mean, to add a few points to that, guys, like, I mean, Yes Bank did have its own sort of particular set of challenges as well, right? I mean, those particular set of challenges, again, I mean, obviously there's a, you know, huge amount of sort of criminal and civil sort of investigations going on into what actually happened at Yes Bank. But there is a fairly, you know, good degree of certainty that something was, you know, definitely wrong in the bank's books, which you can see from, you know, when they were trying to raise money sort of last year, the interest that they got from various investors, I mean, A, they had very limited sort of institutional interest, which, you know, again, sort of before coronavirus was a bit hard to sort of digest, given there was so much, you know, hunt for yield all over the world. Even in spite of that, they managed to find, you know, three investors, of whom two were, you know, to put it mildly, you know, not really good for the money. Basically trying to say, like, Yes Bank had its own set of challenges, but they basically came to fore because of the issue that sort of absorbs most banks and NBFCs right now. And I think, you know, again, Mitchell, and we discussed this before, but, like, you know, the former CEA sort of wrote a pretty interesting paper in this regard.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess, yeah, I mean, if you kind of want to look at it, you know, we have to kind of draw a line between the business end of things as well as the macro environment. And yeah, I mean, Yes Bank obviously was showing a fair bit of red flags for quite some time. But I mean, from a thematic standpoint, do you think the days of, you know, unsecured lending, as well as, you know, fintechy type of platforms, which are, you know, using, you know, kind of, which have a data-driven worldview in this new economic paradigm, those days are kind of behind us now? Or do you feel this is just a kind of 2 to 3 quarter cycle, which is going to recover in due course?
I don't think the sort of, you know, fintech wave and, you know, data-driven sort of approach to underwriting is going away. I think that is going to stay. Unsecured lending, you know, that approach specifically applies to unsecured lending. So I think that is going to suffer, but that is because, you know, unsecured lending will probably not fare very well in, you know, times that we come out of the crisis or sort of the lockdown from coronavirus. I think, though, the question you're asking is, you know, is the companies that have big unsecured books today, I think, yes, they are definitely going to suffer. My guess would be, you know, those guys see pretty large amounts of write-offs.
Right, but I'm also kind of thinking from a philosophical standpoint, right, that entire kind of fintech-oriented worldview was that, you know, look, there's a lot of, I would say, so-called non-prime borrowers out there. They don't have any kind of viable assets to, you know, put in as collaterals. But, you know, we are going to do a deep dive into, you know, different types of metrics. And I know you have very fairly strong views on that in terms of, you know, how traditional underwriting is there for a reason. But, you know, there was that entire promise of a new world where traditional underwriting has its place, but this new data-driven approach has its own place. But I think when really the S hits the fan, as it has in these circumstances, I mean, to be fair, that approach does lose a bit of its, I would say, validity or credibility, does it? Or would people actually draw that line that, you know, this is a force majeure kind of a situation, so we cannot really paint everything with that same brush?
I would like to answer that question with some amount of, you know, more detail. I think data-driven underwriting is here to stay. I think the sort of, you know, approach where we had a single bank manager or, you know, a team thereof sitting down and underwriting loans, that approach is probably not going to come back for
retail and for SME. Just because it's, you know, too time consuming and too sort of labor intensive to sort of go back to that approach. I think the question is, did anyone really have good data models to begin with, right? A lot of people claim they had, data definitely is going to be a very important part of underwriting. I don't think that is going to go away because of, you know, the impact of coronavirus. I think what's going to be found out is very few people actually did a good job in using that data to do underwriting. A lot of people claimed that they were doing very good underwriting, you know, using data. And I think that division in the market will become fairly clear in terms of performance of loans.
I mean, I'm, you know, thinking of things like, you know, I don't know, psychometric tests, like some guys claim to look at social media activity in a great amount of detail. I mean, I always used to think that those are, at the end of the day, I mean, they are good add-ons, but they are not replacements for the fundamental inputs that you need to underwrite. And I mean, I feel that at least, you know, I mean, that line would now be drawn, because those models obviously are, you know, kind of driven a lot by, I would say, VC interest, a lot of external funding coming in. So they get that kind of legitimacy. But when circumstances like these come, then it kind of acts as a natural cleansing mechanism, does it?
No, that's a very interesting point, Nikhil. And I think, you know, you're kind of alluding to, you know, the same point that I wanted to make, but probably did not do it very well. So there are quite a few, you know, variables in any underwriting model. Some of those variables are more standard in nature, right? Like the sort of more standard variables are, you know, things the likes of which, you know, someone like a psycho is in the US. So has the guy been paying off his previous credit card bills in full? Has he ever delayed payments on his credit card bills, you know? Has he been paying his electricity bills on time? You know, what about other loan outstandings that he has? Stuff like that is what, you know, a traditional model of underwriting has been based on, which also is fairly sort of data-driven at this point in time, right? You don't really have, at least, I mean, in most parts of the world, you don't really have a person sitting down and pouring through, you know, those reams of data and deciding whether it makes sense or not. You typically have an algorithm using those variables to decide whether, you know, a person is creditworthy or not. Then there's this whole, you know, thing about new age, you know, data variables that were coming up. So with the likes you mentioned, I mean, you know, is someone actually using Facebook, you know, in a way that gives me some correlation to his creditworthiness? What does his Facebook friend network look like? You know, what are the various sort of contacts he has on his cell phone? And I think, you know, usefulness of some of these variables hasn't really been proven out because there hasn't been credit crisis, so to speak, of, right? And that's this is probably when we're going to find out if those variables actually work or not. And I think what both of us are saying is we feel a lot of them are going to be found lacking. And I think that's a fair point to make.
Yeah, but here's one thing, right? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, the problem statement is to how to identify the creditworthiness, right? I mean, obviously, you can approach it in so many ways. You can use different data points from psychometric to actual recurring payments pattern and cadence and all that. But I don't think, sort of, you know, how do you address the point that an event like COVID is not something that anyone would ever model, right? I mean, it's not something that retail guys would model. It's not like underwriters would model. It's not what businesses would model as well. No one expects to be in a lockdown for, let's call it, 3 odd weeks or maybe even a month, right? So, don't you think there'll be a lot of sort of, like, how do you get rid of that noise? Because this isn't, I mean, there's one way to argue, like, you know what, it's not a, in accounting, people always use, like, non-recurring. And I'm sure, like, in companies will start reporting COVID-adjusted EBITDA and shit like that, right? But how do you sort of model something so unique, right? Like, it's just near impossible. I mean, you can have more data points, but it's just so unique with no precedent, right? I mean, that's the challenge, isn't it?
I agree with that, Sharad. So, like, you know, asking a credit model to account for something like COVID, which obviously has never happened before, I mean, or at least not happened before in our living, you know, memories, is too high a bar. And I mean, if someone was modeling it on that basis, then, you know, they probably would not be making any loans in the last few years because, you know, everyone else is beating them to the interest rate they want to charge a borrower. That being said, I mean, I think I don't think I'm taking anything away from the obvious that defaults overall should go up. How much they go up, we don't know, right? But let's say defaults traditionally in the unsecured space are at you know, 3 to 4%. And I mean, I'm just talking, you know, prime and sort of subprime combined. There'll be certain cases in which, you know, you had, let's say, traditional underwriting models, the sort of stuff, you know, Nikhil and I sort of have more confidence in, you know, stuff based on, you know, again, whether Nikhil's been paying his credit card bills on time, etc. And let's see what the defaults there do. Do they go from like 3 to 4% to 6%? And in the other cases where there's more, you know, quote unquote funky variables, do the defaults go up to as high as, you know, 9% or even higher, right? How much do the defaults overall change? I think that will make a huge difference in terms of whether these models are actually worth the money that people spent on them, you know, pre-coronavirus.
Yeah. And the thing is, this, you guys have worked in credit, but there are no success metrics that you can sort of track over time and see whether a particular kind of strategy works, right? Or it's more qualitative, right? And it varies so individually, correct? Or like it can be modeled out and sort of extrapolated to the larger business model. It's a difficult task, right?
It is a difficult task, but I mean, again, sort of going away from the world, you know, Nikhil used to work in, which was more sort of, you know, you sort of look at one particular exposure and see what the risk behind that is. When you're talking about more, you know, what we call programmatic underwriting or algorithmic underwriting, there is enough amount of data, I think, honestly, to be able to say, you know, what approach worked better for what set of clients. So I think there is enough data to be able to say that objectively. The only issue is that data is very rarely available publicly. Very few people will, you know, actually turn up and say, hey guys, you know, this whole Facebook thing that we were doing, actually it doesn't help. I don't know if enough people have that level of sort of honesty, frankly, to come out and say, you know, that didn't work and we're going back to using traditional metrics.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I mean, we were kind of talking also a bit about like underwriting models. And one thing that I really found insightful was, I think it was a Bloomberg Quint story or something where, you know, they were talking about the stress tests of RBI. So, when we are looking at the stress tests, they kind of assumed, they basically did workings for whatever is the capital adequacy ratio, right, of the Indian banking sector for a certain level of standard deviations, correct? So, like, currently, like, the CRR is around 15%, I mean, pre-COVID, obviously. And they did, like, when you assume, like, a serious shock assumption, which kind of assumes a standard deviation of 2, so that 15% will drop to around 11.2% by September 2020.
Right.
And, the writer of that article seems to think that a standard deviation of 2 is not good enough to reflect COVID. It has to be like 3.5 or 4. That's when the CRR drops below 9%, which is the minimum regulatory capital as mandated. I mean, obviously, it doesn't include the recent announcements that came from the Reserve Bank, you know, in terms of TLTRO, in terms of liquidity injection in the banking system. So, in terms of any kind of recap, it's basically a base case assumption, right? But there is obviously, if no recap is done, if no kind of action is taken, there is a realistic chance that many, many banks would actually become capital starved. So it's kind of a very, I would say, pivotal point. But like, you know, let's step back. And Anuj, if you like look at a bank's balance sheet, you know, just for the benefit of our listeners, I guess on the asset side, obviously we are looking at, you know, potentially higher NPAs, which would have some sort of a hit on equity, you know, from the perspective of provisions, etc. Then I guess loan growth is going to be seriously affected, right? And then on the liability side, I mean, also, I guess wholesale funding is an obvious thing, which is already being hit. But do you feel deposits are also something which are at risk, or that is something more specific to the few names that we keep on seeing at frequent intervals?
Good question, a really good question. And I think there's a two-part answer to this. I think one is, of course, we need to discuss what happens to banks. But I think we definitely need to discuss what happens to NBFCs, especially given, you know, the conditions of this moratorium. But we'll start in a bit. To answer your first question, I think deposits, you're already seeing some stress, right?
Yeah.
I mean, IndusInd was, I think, one bank that the market has been following fairly closely. They lost close to 10% of their deposits in a fairly short span of time. I don't remember exactly what time it was, but they lost about 10% of their deposits going away to sort of, more like PSUs. It's very hard conclusively to say where they went, but, the most educated guesses I read was, most of these guys are pulling their deposits and taking them to PSUs, which frankly, makes a lot of sense, like, especially given the how the RBI managed the sort of Yes Bank sort of fallout. And again, I wasn't in their shoes, so I can't really say whether they had or did not have any better alternative. But essentially what it's done in the mind of the public is, there is a possibility where even if, my deposits are not lost to me, I might not be able to access them for a fairly long period of time. I mean, look at the sort of ramifications it had for the wider sort of, payments industry as well. Like, PhonePe was down for a few days, and that's huge. It's things like that that make you realize, guys, let's definitely not put all my eggs in one basket. And in fact, 0.5% more on my FD return does not justify the risk of putting it in, let's say, an IndusInd versus keeping my money in an SBI, right? So I think it's very, very famously it was put by someone whose name I forget, that and in times like these, people care more about, the return of my money than the return on my money. And I think that is a scenario that we are sort of, facing with most of these private sector banks. So I think maybe barring, let's say, the seriously good names like HDFC, there will be certain, definite issues in terms of, deposit leakages, away from private sector banks into more, public sector undertaking.
Yeah, I guess I think, I remember when I came back, my parents had kind of, bank accounts in, Indian Overseas Bank, and, there were like four or five accounts, and I was like, oh, let's consolidate them into one. And now I think the strategy should be reverse. They should diversify the bank accounts as well, no?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I was just saying, all of this, especially when I talk to, people like my parents and their friends, all of them who are exactly one of the savers that this bank market is usually targeting, they feel even more convinced that a large part of their sort of, liquid wealth, quote unquote, is in gold now. And I think that's, maybe they're actually, right. In the last, the other thing is, when I moved back, I kept telling my parents to invest a little bit in the market. But I think I read the statistics somewhere, last 12 to 13 years, FD returns have actually been a lot better than, returns if you invested in the BSE. Obviously, a lot of that is because of what happened, last 2 months. But again, that there's some indication for, mom-and-pop investors in sort of that segment of the market as well.
I think, Sharath, you were saying, right, that cash has been the best asset class?
Yeah. And
that was pre-COVID, if I recall.
That was way before. I think as we stepped into this year, we were looking at sort of how overall returns as an asset class, and cash was, it was the best performing asset. And I remember when I moved back as well, there was the whole mutual fund Sahiya campaign, and like, you don't see those guys anymore, right? I mean, at the end of the day, right, I mean, we've been taught, like, the textbook would tell you about diversification and sort of having, some dividend paying, interest paying investments to, like, long-term bets. Like, this is a good example, right, that you've got to diversify yourself. Like, I mean, this is the kind of times when that thesis gets tested. I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, people who are, like, very nicely diversified have done fairly well. You have to be a Bill Ackman to make calculated bets and bet against with the market when the time is right. But other than that, you just got to play long-term, I guess, and have diversified investment, which includes your FDs, which you said, and also equity. And unfortunately, we don't have too much liquidity in the government bonds and bonds in India, but that would also be a nice part of the portfolio if we had that liquidity, right?
I mean, to be fair, there's nothing wrong with the fundamentals, What I think things really go wrong is, I mean, if you look at someone like Yes Bank itself, like I remember, like Anuj, I think you were following it much closely than me, but around 2 years ago, I looked at their, accounts in a fair amount of detail. The numbers looked okay. I mean, now the problem is that if the numbers themselves are questionable, then what can you do, right? So, I mean, it then becomes a question of whether there is mis-selling. I mean, whether there is mis-selling or whether there are corporate governance issues those are, to be fair, very difficult to price in. I mean, like when you're talking of like mutual funds, say, now if debt mutual funds are exposed to, you know, A-tier one of Yes Bank, or if A-tier one of Yes Bank is directly being sold to retail guys, I mean, there's frankly little that the retail guy can also figure out, right, at the end of the day.
And I think, you know, we probably underestimate the amount of mis-selling that our parent generation has been through. I mean, I distinctly recall reading, you know, business magazines at that point, which would talk about, you know, all of these guys, like, you know, they would invest into teak plantations, but none of them actually did it. And all of that money eventually went into, you know, some bank account that no one's heard of since then. So there's been a lot of mis-selling to our parent generation, I think, and which is also why they tend to stick to, you know, a traditional sort of bank FD route, which is why, you know, it was actually a shock to me when I realized how much of AT1 that Yes Bank has sold has actually been to retail.
Yeah, almost half, right? Or 44% or something, if I recall.
Yeah. But just coming back to the, you know, question you were asking. So, yeah, I think, you know, deposits definitely will take a bit of a hit.
But you estimate it's going to be more a question of diversification towards PSBs, moving away from private sector, yes, because there's that natural kind of moral hazard that PSBs would be bailed out at the end of the day. So
that's true. And I think also the deposit protection limit has been increased, right? So that is something people still definitely believe in. I mean, I think I would take that bet. The other thing is, you know, overall, I mean, again, we don't know for how long the RBI can do this, or maybe they can actually go lower. But rates have definitely come down post-COVID. So any new, even if, let's say, I need to increase my deposit rates to be able to attract more depositors into my bank, if I run a public private sector bank, the room to do that has gone up, right? I think rates were cut by what, like 50 or 75 basis points? I'm not exactly
75
sure of that.
Yeah.
75. So, you know, that's a serious amount of room. The bigger concern for me, I mean, rather than on the asset side for banks, right, which are deposit funded mostly, the bigger concern definitely will be what happens on the liability side, especially with regards to loans. And the other important thing, and, you know, this kind of sort of goes back to the first point I raised on this question, a lot of bank balance sheets are right now being used to provide loans to NBFCs to then go ahead and lend money.
Yeah.
Whether unsecured or for commercial vehicles or auto. And you will see a lot of stress, I think, on that side of the balance sheet as well. Not just, you know, direct loans that they've made to corporates, which would, you know, struggle for obvious reasons, but also the loans that they've made to NBFCs.
Right. And
I think so. And like, CapEx will come down from the corporate side, like companies which are sort of, there is a massive slowdown, right, which will have that spillover effect. So, I also sort of see massive slowdown in the growth of their loan book as well, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, we can sort of run a very simple mathematical model in our own mind. This is interesting how the reporting for banks, it's so different between a low growth versus a high growth market, right? In a low growth market, you typically report defaults on a cohort level. So you say, you know, I made these loans in, let's say, I of 07, and this is how they've performed. In a high growth market, you typically, and, you know, like in India, you always typically talk about NPL as a percentage of book. Now, what tends to happen when you do that is, in a high growth market, a lot of defaults get lost in just the sheer amount of growth in the book. So, I mean, you know, for the last few years, loan book growth of like 20-25% is not unheard of. I mean, even I think HDFC was growing around that same number, doing, you know, what they claimed is very safe lending.
Yeah.
If you have a loan book that's growing from, you know, 100 to 125 and then going to 200 over 5 years, your actual defaults over 5 years have only been on the first 100 that you lent out. So even if you've lent out, you know, let's say if you've lent out 100 and you've defaulted on 5, by the time that your loan book is 2x the number, your loss rates look like a meager, 2.5%, which is very different to what starts to happen when growth of loan book slows down. which I think, you know, Sharat, you're exactly right. What will start happening is people will start revising their NPA forecast as well, because the numbers that will come out for losses in a low growth environment will substantially be higher than what they were previously, just by virtue of, you know, the book not growing fast enough.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's very interesting. The sort of how you look at, you know, a bank financial statement or a lending financial statement in a high growth versus low growth environment. That should be fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, and what do you think is the way forward, though, man? Like obviously we all know that we're looking at a few years slowdown. Things are not, you know, things will be choppy. But what is the way forward? If you were running, let's say, an NBFC or even a bank, or you were sort of thinking about, you know, do you sort of hedge yourself, pull back a little bit on lending? Do you sort of know, like, try to lend? Like, how do you sort of get out of it, or just wait? Like, the time is the best thing. Like, they wait for the economic activity to pick up, and generally it comes with credit growth, right? So, is that how, or are there actual, at a macro level, I get it. Like, you know, you put more liquidity into the system so that the credit markets don't break down, and that's what RBI has done as well, right? And across the world as well. You know, the rates a little bit to jack up demand, but what do you sort of, what other things can you possibly do? Like, is there other things that can be done?
So I think it really depends. If I'm running an NBFC, it really depends on, hey, how much cash am I sitting on? You know, how much equity capital do I have? Versus, you know, is everything I own in a loan book already, right?
Mm-hmm.
If everything is in a loan book already, which, you know, has been typically the case. I mean, people were hungry for capital, you know, even last year before coronavirus. I mean, there were, you know, several stories I heard of, you know, NBFC guys who were just making regular trips to New York and London trying to raise money for their operation.
Right.
If you were in that camp where, you know, you were actually sitting on very limited amount of liquidity, at this point, I think your focus has to be on collection. I mean, you can't really be thinking about growing a loan book at this point in time. Because, you know, it's unfortunately going to cause a double whammy, because once you start focusing on collection, which you haven't really done in the past, I know very few people who actually have very good collection systems, you know, in India, other than Bajaj, for instance. You know, these guys, And most public sector banks have good coverage as well. But like most of the fintech guys, they've never really focused that much on the collection side of things so far. They've always been sort of, you know, going for growth. I think at this point, this is what you need to focus on being able to collect back your money once the lockdown eases and, you know, the moratorium is lifted as well. And again, you know, the moratorium might be extended, who knows? But
yeah,
at this point, I think all of your energies would be on that. If on the other side, you're a guy who has the liquidity, you know, also has, like, you know, a small loan book. So maybe, you know, guys who started off sometime last year raised, you know, a few million bucks and haven't really grown a loan book but are looking to see what they do with it. I think the time, I would definitely think there'll be, you know, extremely good opportunities in credit that actually come through in the next 1 year or so. And maybe it's more of hope as well rather than an actual fact. I do think, you know, there'll be a lot more interesting opportunities that will come through in the market, because, you know, banks and NBFCs will have to pull back on what they've been doing. So in that sense, the best approach is to wait and watch. And maybe, you know, you've already identified a few niches you want to go after. So maybe just, you know, keep evaluating what's changed there. I mean, if your niche was lending to restaurants, then maybe you should, you know, think a bit again about your entire sort of strategy. But, you know, mm-hmm. if your niche was, I don't know, sort of lending to hospitals, then, you know, you should just wait and watch and see when is a good time to sort of go in and start making these deals again.
But I mean, Anuj, like you mentioned the moratorium a couple of times. What's your view on it? In the sense that, me and Sharat were discussing it in the last episode, and RBI has done something quite interesting. Like, they have given an advisory, they have not actually given a mandate. So it's then up to individual banks and NBFCs to, you know, kind of evaluate things and form policies or do things on a case-by-case basis. I mean, obviously, a few big public sector banks have already given a blanket moratorium, but a lot of the smaller guys, private sector banks, they are kind of, you know, sitting on the fence for obvious reasons. They're putting the onus on the borrower rather than themselves giving blanket moratoriums. Do you think RBI did a fair, like from a borrower's standpoint, RBI was fair in the way they have taken and structured this?
I think from a borrower perspective.
Sorry, I mean, from a lender's perspective. I'm sorry.
From a lender's perspective, right. So, Nikhil, I think I'm a bit confused, right, on what actually happened.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know the facts. I just don't know what the sort of thinking behind it is. And by the way, I'm not claiming that the RBI itself is confused. I am a bit confused what the result of all of this. Let's just take an example of a fintech guy who was doing unsecured lending, right? Yeah. And you and I know there's you know tons of people doing that right now.
Yeah.
You know for a fact that unless you were lending to people who were sort of, you know, salaried, and even then you'd have some stress. Unless you were doing that, the chances of you getting money back from most of these borrowers is next to zero in the next, you know, 21, 30 days while there is a lockdown. Most microfinance guys, you know, if they're expecting to get sort of, you know, decent amount of repayment back in this period of time, are probably, you know, kidding themselves. Or they know something I don't.
Yeah.
But really sort of doubt that. So this, you would have had to offer this moratorium to your buyers if you were a reasonable lender anyways, right? I mean, if you've lent money to your mate, for instance, who's now one master partner, what do you do? I mean, do you, as a lender, really have an alternative at this point as to call her up and say, no, you have to return the money? I mean, you can't even send a collection team to her house, right? So you kind of would have had to do it.
Yeah.
The reason I think the RBI said, you know, there's a moratorium is because, and might sound like conspiracy theory, but, you know, the reason I say it is because banks would have had to offer this in any case, I think, to most of their borrowers.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was no moratorium, they would have actually had to say that their credit losses have gone up, which would dramatically impact equity at the end of it as well. Right? So coming, the CER ratio that you were mentioning, right?
Yeah.
Within these 2 months, you would have had to take massive write-downs on that because a large part of your unsecured book would go from, you know, current to 60 days past due or 90 days past due or, you know, whoever were your guys who were definitely 90 days past due and you were somehow managing and not having to take a write-down on those guys, they definitely go into 120 days past due and then your sort of, you know, credit policy kicks in place. You have to take more, you know, write-downs on your equity, which further reduces the amount you can lend when things sort of stabilize.
Yeah, so just to simplify for our listeners, basically, the idea here is that when loans are going bad, then banks are supposed to hold some sort of an equity buffer against them. So the classification of the loans become quite important. So I guess the point here is that I think it was kind of explicitly mentioned in the RBI's regulatory package that, you know, if a moratorium is granted, you don't have to reclassify the asset on your books. So you don't have to actually hold additional equity or, you know, hold additional provisions. So yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, Nihil, I think you explained it beautifully, right? Like this is basic. I mean, let's again talk about a single unsecured lender, right? And he's made one loan to someone who's now gone back to Patna. There is practically no way he can enforce on that loan, right? The real possibility for this guy is right now, as in when the lockdown is still in place, to extend and pretend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really the only option he has at this point.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, once the lockdown eases, either the sort of, you know, person starts making money again, in which case, you know, he has a good enough collection team that he can go back and collect from them.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, he doesn't even have that. And I don't know, you know, on what basis he had lent out the money in the first place, but, you know, that sort of short window of faith that he had is also gone.
But right? Would it have been better if, say, the government backstopped it rather than actually just defer the entire...
So,
I mean, at the end of the day, like you know, the thing is that, like, the person that, the fictitious borrower that we're talking about, I mean, after 3 months, he or she has to, anyways, I mean, they're operating in a totally different, I would say, space, right? And then they'll have accrued interest, their general average payments are going to go up in any case. So do you think the government should have just said that, okay, look, this is like a kind of a, instead of taking a write down, we'll backstop it and let's move on? Or do you think that was just too big a number, so that's why they did not actually go for it?
I don't know the answer to that, Nikhil. I mean, it probably is too big a number. That's for sure. I mean, it's definitely not like, you know, a tiny number.
Yeah.
In terms of a total unsecured outstanding, that would probably, you know, start facing stress as a result of this.
Right.
But, I mean, in my mind, conceptually, how I think about it is, you know, in the US and in UK, for instance, when the government has come out with policies where they are pretty much guaranteeing income for, you know, their citizens, right? They're saying people who are making, so the UK policy I know decently well,
yeah,
it says people who are self-employed and, you know, making less than, I think, £50,000 a year, the government will ensure they get paid at least 80% of that for the next, you know, I think 6 months, but maybe 3 months, right?
Wow.
If you're at least going to get paid that number,
mm-hmm,
you can afford to keep paying your lender as well. So the UK government has not actually declared any moratoriums per se. I mean, there are certain other issues with how they're dealing with sort of, you know, credit and sort of banking institutions themselves, but they haven't really declared any moratorium as such. They're obviously saying, you know, people are free to make forbearance sort of adjustments on loans as they want, but these forbearances need to be recorded. Now, essentially, in my mind, what happened is here, the government came in and said, you know, the pain of lost wages is going to be taken by the government through essentially what seems very akin to a universal basic income sort of program, right? Yeah. Whereas in India, what the government is saying is, we are not going to take the pain of this UBI. We are going to pass it on to the lenders, equity holders, right? This pain needs to be taken by them. Now, the other point you mentioned, Nikhil, on in terms of accrued interest, now there's no clear guideline on when that accrued interest needs to be paid. It doesn't have to be necessarily paid at the end of the moratorium. It can also be paid at the very end of the loan itself. Right. It can also be paid over the duration, you know, of the remaining tenure of the loan. So the government's been silent on that as well, which again, you know, sort of lend some value to my theory. Again, might be a conspiracy theory that, you know, it's more of extend and pretend to say, you know, this payment is not immediately due at the end of the moratorium. You can charge it, you know, in 5 years when your loan actually completely sort of, you know, matures.
Which makes sense to an extent as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does, right? I'm just not sure what the, yeah, as Nikhil was saying, I'm just not sure what the rationale behind it is.
Behind the?
Is it really trying to help the borrowers, or is it just trying to say, you know, we don't want our NBFCs to record how much equity they actually have lost?
Yeah. I mean, I think, to be fair, I read it as primarily some sort of liquidity relief. That's the extent of it, right? That, okay, don't call me for 3 months. And after things are as they are. And you pay some extra. I mean, and the government has left it open-ended enough for banks to, you know, structure it as per their own business models. I mean, that's kind of, but yeah, it's not, I mean, for me, it's not really a quote-unquote moratorium in the purest sense from that standpoint. I mean, a moratorium would be like a actual relief, right? From a borrower standpoint, at least. I mean, in this case, it's more of a cash
timing.
Cash buffer that you get.
The cash buffer, though, I mean, has a pretty big implication for, you know, NBFCs that did not have a lot of capital or cash to hand to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I get actually concerned more on the, like, as you were also pointing out on the liability side. If you look at, like, commercial paper or, you know, wholesale funding in general. I mean, we'll also discuss a bit about that. I mean, you know, I guess the Federal Reserve's approach in the US has been quite different from that of RBI. I mean, that's my understanding. Like the Fed is actually buying corporate bonds, actually funding institutions and corporates directly. Whereas I think in the RBI's case, it's still going to be kind of an indirect channel through repo transactions. So that's where I think the biggest risk is, that even a 3 month deferred period can actually hit the cash position a lot of these NBFCs, which are pretty much responsible for, I don't know, like 1 in 5 new loans at this stage. That's, I think, the real, I would say, source of worry here.
And I mean, just to sort of take a step back, guys, you remember, like, even before sort of, you know, coronavirus hit, we were discussing how quite a few NBFCs are having trouble sort of raising new money, right? And this was actually captured quite well in the former CEO's report as well, where he showed, you know, how much of the mutual fund, the investment into NBFCs has actually, you know, gone off a cliff. Yeah. I think it fell by close to like 50% year on year on, you know, the data that he was considering. And this is before sort of the coronavirus issue actually happened. So the moratorium, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it does not really talk about the treatment of liabilities for an NBFC, right? So it definitely says on the asset side, if a borrower requests a moratorium, then, you know, the NBFC may grant it, right? That's, I think, the language. Whereas it doesn't really say what happens on the liability side. So if an NBFC grants moratorium on, let's say, 100% of its loan, does it also get interest, you know, relief on the loan that it's taken from, you know, the likes of an RBL? What happens to those interest payments? And let's say, you know, RBL comes in and says, I'm going to waive off collecting interest on the loans that are given to you to fund these loans to consumers for the next 3 months.
Yeah.
How does RBL then continue to make payments on its deposits and its, you know, coupons on the bonds that it issued? At some point, there will be a few people who will not be able to take, even though it's just a cash dislocation issue, they might not be able to pay that.
So, like, you're pointing towards, like, some sort of an like asset liability mismatch that will naturally happen.
Which
the RBI has not really explicitly mentioned on how they'll deal with it.
They haven't mentioned how they're going to deal with it. So I came across a very interesting sort of, report / recommendation by these guys at Northern Arc. What they are saying is, this moratorium is going to happen if the investors who have invested in the securitized loan don't really want to take losses, they might as well allow moratoriums, on the debt payment to them as well.
Right.
And that, you know, basically they're saying, guys, this is it. We can't do much more than this. If you guys actually want to get some money back, you might as well, not be asking you for, not be asking the securitization SPV for interest payments at this point in time.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, to be fair, I mean, there are some kind of, I mean, in terms of the borrowing window that the banks and NBFCs have with regard to the RBI, that has expanded, right? The exact mechanics of it are not clear at this stage, to be fair.
I mean, while that is true, so I mean, see, liquidity is one side of things, and liquidity, so by the way, it's super interesting what happened last time there were, sort of crises in the Indian financial sector, right? Both of them have happened very, very very recent past. One was ILFS and the other was demonetization. When both of those caused severe stress on NBFC's balance sheets as well. I mean, ILFS more on the sort of liability side of things, and demonetization on the asset side of things. Even at that point, because of additional liquidity, the borrowing costs went down for good names. But stress names obviously suffered even more. And good names like, let's say, Bajaj or HDFC, the compression spreads for them pretty much followed increased amount of liquidity in the market. That, again, this time, people who have, as I was saying, people who have enough capital and equity to hand, for them, this might be actually a very good opportunity because, their funding costs might drop. They'll see a lot of people pulling back from lending. So, when they were making loans at 12% last year, the same loan can probably be made at 15-16% now. So in both cases, they're sort of... NIM is going to go up. But for guys who are even a bit stressed, this could be, the time when the party gets over.
Whoa, that's depressing. And,
I said I was going to be bullish
another interesting angle to watch out is, I don't know exactly what the number is, banks who have, kind of not that much dependency on interest income, on the investment banking side, bond trading, I guess. That I think might be somewhat of an island of positivity amongst this entire game.
I mean, unless of course you mean Carvey.
So we are finally saying some names now. Well done. Me and Sharad are like, what is wrong with this guy? He's not like naming any names today. So.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're right.
In terms of names, right? I think you'll see a distinction between the likes of Piramal, who I think were sort of stressed names to begin with. Versus the likes of, let's say, Bajaj. Now, even Bajaj has seen a huge drop in stock price.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they'll probably come out of this okay. I mean, let me put it this way. I think if they start facing stress, then it's going to be pretty bad all around. So I think those guys are going to be fine. But the guys that are already stressed, the likes of Piramal, they're going to suffer even more.
So who do you think are the guys who will be all right? Bajaj, you obviously mentioned comparatively.
I think comparatively, right? So I think like overall they might also drop from where they are. Very hard to say what happens there, but I think they'll probably survive and see through this at PFC. So I think the usual guys. I guess what I'm basically saying is, you know, right now the time, if you want to really invest into financials, you should go for quality, rather than try and go for, you know, people who are traditionally more growth based.
No, so I mean, even recently, I think when you mentioned HDFC, I was just recalling, wasn't there like some negative news flow on that as well? Or maybe I'm just kind of thinking of the wrong name.
No, Nikhil, I think you're right. The negative news flow around HDFC was more on how, you know, India so far has never really had a big consumer credit issue.
Right.
And that's probably going to happen now in coronavirus. And if I remember right, like that's what you meant. And I don't disagree with that.
But I mean, as a kind of flight to quality, it's still one of the better guys, right?
I think even in terms of consumers, like HDFC's loan book and probably even Bajaj's loan book is going to be better than, you know, a lot of sort of the fintech guys you see out there today.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the more important thing is, you know, both HDFC and Bajaj have invested quite a lot into collections networks.
Okay.
Which I don't think is the case for, you know, as I was saying, a lot of these sort of new age fintech guys.
Right. What's your, I mean, now we'll kind of switch gears a bit. Obviously, we've spent a fair amount of time on the banking sector. It was super interesting. What's your take on your favorite topic, startup funding?
Right. So, guys, actually, I was preparing for this, right? Before this podcast started, I went back into what prediction, you know, we had made in the podcast last year.
Right.
And I think, I mean, from Uber was one we spent almost 15 minutes talking about.
Yeah.
I think all of us, all three of us were fairly bearish on that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, traded at 40, listed at 40, today traded at around 23. So I think that was a pretty good call.
Enough said there.
Sorry?
Enough said in that.
Enough said.
Yeah.
We have discussed WeWork.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't really need to go into that.
Yeah.
We guys discussed another smaller company, which obviously isn't listed, and, you know, maybe a lot of your listeners won't know about them, called Drip Capital.
Yeah.
Drip Capital was one I was actually bullish on last year.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like, as time has progressed, what I'm realizing is, you know, those guys have actually also not done very well.
Right.
So the only one guy that I was bullish on also, you know, hasn't really sort of worked out.
Right. Did we discuss Oyo?
Surprisingly, I don't think we did on the podcast.
Yeah, but in life we did.
In life we definitely did. Countless hours have gone, you know, that we never get back discussing Oyo.
Our Uber conversation was before the IPO, right?
Yes. It was before the IPO.
And we knew that it's not going to be a pleasant one. And it's, even before the COVID thing, it was sort of struggling anyway. So.
Yes. I think it went down all the way to 16. And then the CEO had to come in and say, you know, we have enough cash to survive this crisis. And, you know, the weird thing about all of these startups is the less business they do, the longer the runway they have.
Yeah.
So
they all burn immense amount of cash,
So they might do better. They might stay for longer.
They might actually do better post-coronavirus, for sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, guys, one question from me to you, right?
Yeah.
And I've been reading a lot about this, and again, you know, opinion is extremely divided. Going into coronavirus, right?
Yeah.
Let's assume you had a view on big tech, which was, you know, let's say giving them a 10 out of 10. Let's say that was your view. Has your view materially changed sort of since coronavirus, and how useful or not you found, you know, big tech to be in general? And I think that is relevant because it'll dovetail very well into our startup conversation.
Okay. No, that's it. That's super interesting. I guess the popular mainstream view right now on big tech, I mean, when you say big tech, you mean like the US big tech, right? Obviously. So,
even like a Swiggy or Zomato here, right? I mean, maybe you want to include them as well.
Do you want to include them?
Let's find out in two different ways then, right?
Yeah.
What has your view been of US big tech versus, you know, tech generally in our country?
I mean, US big tech, I think, I mean, the mainstream view has been that it will only become stronger now. But I think that way, me and Sharath were chatting about it, And we were like, obviously, like the models which are kind of, you know, subscription driven, they will strengthen. They are already strengthening. But, you know, ad driven, because they have like an externality to the broader, you know, macroeconomic situation.
Right.
For them, it's still a wait and watch. So, I mean, so yeah, obviously, like the idea being that if you look at like a Netflix or, you know, on an Amazon, there is obviously a utility there which is being served. But yeah, if you look at like an Instagram or a Facebook in terms of like, which are very like 85 to 90% advertising revenue driven, for them, one still has to kind of, I think, wait and watch.
Right.
I guess, Sharad, I don't know if that was pretty much, I think, the gist of it, right?
Unless I'm yeah, no, that's sort of, and also like there are utility companies who are sort of, you know, enterprise companies. You know, this COVID will accelerate some of the tech embracement as well as we, and Slack is probably a fantastic example, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there'll be a lot of beneficiaries from there. So people will realize that there was a lot of redundant activities that were going on for which tech is a solution. So from that perspective, their usefulness gets heightened. That's one thing. But like the other big tech companies, I mean, they're sort of, I think, will get even stronger as well. But on the subscription side, I mean, listen, if there's a massive economic downturn and you're seeing the kind of jobless numbers that are being reported in US, if that sort of picks up, there will be subscription companies that will feel the burn, right? I mean, Netflix, again, is one of those examples. And in the last 1 year, we've seen so many tech guys embrace content, which is like a highly capital-intensive endeavor. And none of them make free cash flow. I mean, Netflix doesn't make free cash flow. It's a different thing that, you know, like Disney and things like that, they have their other brick and mortar theme parks and all, which again will also feel the burn right now with lack of attendance. But generally, like if the economic activity sort of subsides and there's joblessness and there's general slowdown, you will see some of that people cut off their subscriptions. So there will be a dip the longer it prolongs. But the relevance of some of these utility companies, I think, is there. It's very much intact in terms of what people are doing. I mean, I'm sure Netflix will report like absolutely stellar traffic numbers, right? I mean, you got to look at what numbers are relevant. But
I mean, even guys who have bet big on the cloud, right? I mean, if you look at like Microsoft, like everybody's now is talking about Microsoft Teams, you know, like which was kind of not really in the mainstream before that. So, I mean, that entire Slack utility framework kind of feels, I think, quite positive for the... But yeah, I think everything has a... Like, if the downturn is long enough, then probably they will also start feeling the pain.
Yeah. But lesser than, let's say, non-tech names, right?
Because they just have too much cash, right, on their books. I mean, they are like a... I mean, it kind of is a... I mean, they will basically consolidate. They'll get cheap opportunities to buy. I think their overall entrenchment will only get stronger. I mean, I feel
and I mean, to sort of, you know, look at this question in a slightly different way, I mean, one of the biggest risks regarding big tech that, you know, was being discussed again going into the lockdown and stuff was regulatory risk, right? People thought, you know, these guys are getting just way too big, we need to break them up, like, you know, as you did the Standard Oil and stuff like that, you know, many years past. Do you think that approach is going to suffer as well? Because, you know, people will think, okay, you know, these companies are actually really good companies, you know.
Facebook
is an amazing company that really passed my time.
Yeah, I find that to be a more political question. Like, people are running, like, Elizabeth Warren is running a campaign on sort of breaking up big tech, right? Some of the other guys are not running on that. But for me, like, I think there'll eventually be a time where people will realize that the Amazons and Facebooks and Googles have become way too big and there needs to be more regulatory push and sort of even break it down into smaller companies. That's for me, like, to happen organically, for that to happen, I think it should take some time. But if there's some draconian political shifts in the US, then maybe you can see that accelerated. But for me, like you said, like, I completely agree, the biggest risk is on the regulatory, and the biggest move that will happen will be on the regulatory front.
Right.
I mean, on the regulatory front, what's interesting is that a lot of these guys are getting a lot of goodwill now.
Yeah, that's what I was, you know, kind of alluding to. You do think that is happening, right? So people are now looking at, let's say, someone like a Google or a Facebook much more kindly than what they were going into the sort of COVID crisis.
I mean, it's purely anecdotal, but yeah, I'm getting that feeling as well.
Right. And I think that is, you know, true on sort of what I'm feeling as well. Now, you know, how this dovetails into the whole sort of startup question that we had. You guys might remember this is a point we discussed at length sort of, you know, during the last podcast last year, which was, you know, this sort of go big or go home, don't make money before you IPO sort of approach. Actually has markedly increased the risks for a lot of startup founders. Because, you know, while earlier on you would sort of put money into a business, you would start making money sort of month one or so on. And then, you know, eventually you would have some, you wouldn't be really so reliant on, you know, an IPO to actually be able to make money. I think in a lot of cases, because big tech is only going to become sort of more and more powerful, you see a lot of these sort of, you know, startup founders who've been sort of waiting to exit via an IPO find that their only route of exit now is really to sell up to one of these sort of big tech guys at valuations that probably are not very attractive. And they'll have to do that because, you know, they don't just have those pockets of capital, especially, you know, SoftBank available where they had it before.
Yeah, no, that's I think a fair assessment. I mean, that kind of, I mean, effectively, that entire, you know, I would say startup funding cycle that was, that has been seen in the US, also to a certain extent in India. I mean, a lot of cynicism has now surrounded that at the end of the day. So, and plus, I mean, a lot of guys benefited from that. And, the ones who have kind of, you know, made it through and who have now developed either cash surplus or, you know, sustainable business models, they are at some sort of a systemic advantage. So from that standpoint, there is definitely a risk for the, I won't call it a risk. I mean, it's an exit channel, as you said, but like actually getting absorbed by the bigger fish, that I think is a very, very probable next step that's going to happen. I mean, I've started looking at companies, and like the reaction that one has now is not about how, you know, what's their story, but okay, this seems like they will get acquired by X or Y. You know, that kind of is beginning to creep in.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you know, that in a way sort of answers your question and sort of describes my view on what I feel about the sort of startup ecosystem right now. I think even post WeWork, you know, I was reading a lot of memos sent out by VC firms. And it was probably just mixed service, but, you know, they were saying, guys, you now need to focus on profitability, right?
Yeah.
This growth at all costs mindset you have to drop. And it was a bit rich coming from most of these VC guys, because these were exactly the guys who were saying, hey guys, you need to dream big, right?
Yeah.
To these founders in the first place. I think that definitely was changing. And I think any startup founder who, you know, is going to face the stress of these coming, you know, the past 2 weeks and the coming 3 weeks as well, is going to realize there's, you know, no better funding channel than your own customer. As in, you know, making money from them.
For the new companies, I mean.
I think maybe you're right, but like even for the guys who exist today, I think, you know, profitability and monetization will become fairly important metrics, especially sort of a lot more important than they were in the last few years.
I mean, for them, the question is more, I mean, the path, it's more about the path to profitability for them rather than the, you know, the actually having that business model in place first, rather than the ability to execute it. I mean, the reason why I'm
saying some of them just cannot make money anyway.
I mean, like, I won't say some of them cannot make money, but like, for instance, if you look at, like, say, the space of, I don't know, payments, right? Now, most of the guys who are now into the payments business, they are using payments as a channel to actually cross-sell other things, be it mutual funds, be it financial products, whatever, right?
Payments
as a standalone basis does not really seem to have a business model around it, because now you have, you know, someone like UPI, which is a government infrastructure layer, which is pretty much cannibalizing what most of the payments guys were doing in the first place. So they have a lot of money. They are like funded by Berkshire and all that. So, I mean, I'm sure they'll survive.
You know which one you mean.
Yeah, man.
You know which one you mean.
Yeah, you know, na? Yeah. So I guess for them, it's more about figuring out the path to profitability rather than actually executing it.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, you know, coming to that specific company, sort of Paytm, the one we were talking about, they are spending sort of ginormous amounts in figuring out how, you know, they can start lending on the basis of the data they have.
Yeah.
So I think that is going to be fairly interesting coming out of this crisis and, you know, seeing sort of what the appetite for that is going forward. And, it, you know, I think that really will illustrate the value of the data point these guys actually have. Plus, more importantly, you know, it's the whole conversation about, you know, this merchant needs me on a daily basis to make payments and therefore he's going to continue paying me at the cost of every other lender. Does that really bear out? Like, how what happens to that story? That would be fairly interesting to see.
Yeah, no, lending is the answer. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that's the favored business model in this particular conversation as well, I have a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, Nikhil, could you sort of add to that, right? Like, I think a lot of companies, even if they are not, you know, financial companies to begin with, will need to start moving into lending anyway to sort of, you know, capture a bigger share of the customer wallet. I think that will happen. I mean, I know you guys had Pranesh on your show a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were discussing sort of amongst ourselves how sort of his business model would also probably require some amount of lending. Now, that's just an example of, you know, people we both know and your listeners probably know as well. So, you know, that's one example. But I think I can see a lot of people realizing that, you know, third-party lenders on their platforms just take away too much of the customer sort of share of wallet than, you know, what they get paid as pure originators. I think that shift is definitely well on its way, where people are realizing no matter what I do on the side, I need to be, you know, a fintech company as well.
That's although they're such specialized in different business models, but it's sort of to spruce up demand, right? I mean, give them leverage and people will buy anything. That's sort of the mindset, right?
That is the mindset.
Basically, yeah.
By the way, like, Sharad, I mean, one interesting example here, right, is to look at AWS. I mean, I know there's a huge hardware play there as well, right? And there's a huge tech play there as well. But at the end of the day, I mean, the reason why we prefer AWS than an HP system, right, is because we don't need to pay anything upfront. Like, it's a monthly running cost. Although, I mean, frankly, using an HP system, if you have sort of fairly, you know, well-to-do, sort of well-predictable demand, would probably be cheaper for you than actually using AWS.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, I mean, if you can convert some kind of CapEx into an OpEx, obviously it becomes more lucrative for you to go down that road. It's one of the oldest techniques, right? So I know I see what you're saying and I get that. To get sort of into specialist lending where you're sort of trying to track the creditworthiness and willingness to pay, it becomes such a, what I'm saying is, like, even if it moves towards that, it's such a specialized discipline and business skill set. It's not an easy move like that.
It's not an easy move. Definitely agree with you, and I wasn't claiming it was.
I was
just saying, you know, a lot of people are thinking that's what they want to do, sort of to actually be able to make money.
It probably would make more sense when people are seeing their income dry out, they'd want to get some kind of leverage.
Yeah. I mean, anyways, Shah, like, the one point is the CapEx to OpEx, right?
Yeah.
But the other point is also a lot of the consumer brands, over time, they are realizing that, look, the share of wallet of the typical Indian customer is not that big. So, to start with. So, I mean, we just can't, like the provision of the service is not enough. We need to facilitate the sale through some sort of a cash flow support, right? So, I guess from that perspective as well, kind of converting it, you know, converting everything into like a subscription as a service proposition does make sense. But yeah, it's as you guys were discussing, it's tough to execute. If it was so easy to execute, everyone would be doing it well. And let's kind of see, you know, where the puck moves.
Yeah.
Where the puck moves, a Canadian metaphor. How's that? Cool, guys.
By the way, whenever we are running close to the end of this, there's just one sort of small snippet I'd like to say.
Yeah.
So, I know whenever that actually happens, but I think, you know, all of us have seen it, you know, how difficult it has been for sort of migrant workers to be going back home. And, you know, obviously for the last few weeks, they've had no incomes at all. There's a company that I consult for called Echo that has been sort of, you know, processing domestic money remittances for the past 12 years.
Right.
Over these 12 years, they have, like, you know, excellent data on who was a migrant worker in Bombay or Delhi. Sort of, you know, transferring money back home to his, you know, village in sort of, let's say, Begusarai or Patna. And, you know, at this point, we know who's actually gone back and is not making enough money to be able to make these remittances. So, you know, if you feel like helping out certain such families, just sort of log in to echo.in/donate and, you know, we can get your money to the right place.
echo.in/donate. Cool. I'll also post this in the description.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's good. That's pretty helpful, and obviously, would like to support such initiatives.
Thanks, guys.
No, absolutely. This was fun. This was, I think, quite fairly comprehensive as usual. I have to still check the audio quality. So, like Anuj, if I call you back again to record the entire thing, I mean,
sure.
You know, there's a real chance that might happen.
That's fine.
Yeah.
All right, look forward, guys.
Yeah. No, thank you so much, man. And stay safe and have a good day. And so, yeah, this is pretty much the end of the episode. And I think we'll be back soon with another guest or not. No one can say anything these days. So, yeah. So, this is Nikhil Arora, and I have with me Sher Tupran, and we are signing off.